Hi, this is Hugh Cornwell, and welcome to this Mr. DeMille FM podcast. If you have any comments, suggestions, or simply want to get in touch, then please email info@mrdemillefm.com. This programme is an interview with Nick Moran, actor-turned-director and star of Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. I hope you enjoy the show. Well, it's my great pleasure to welcome Nick Moran here. So welcome, Nick. Thanks for coming and sitting in for this.
Well, thanks for having me. It's an absolute honour. Delighted to be asked.
Now, you brought along a list of films here of some of your favourites.
Yeah. I mean,
you're a bit like me, a cineast, and your favourites change for whatever mood you're
exactly.
in.
Exactly. When you said do a list, it was like, you know, it depends. It could have been a completely different list if it had been a different day, you know. So,
yeah.
My history of cinema, really, it's nothing specifically academic, which actually people get a bit pissed off about. But my dad worked nights. My mum used to let me sit up until the telly went blank, you know, and then, you know, write a late for school note in the morning. So I'd be sat there watching Sergio Leone films when I was like 9 and 10 until midnight. Anything that was a bit racy and on late at night, I'd sit up on the sofa with my mum and then she'd let me be late for school. It wasn't until I went to drama school that I realised, oh yeah, I've seen that. You know, I'd seen all these Antonioni films or whatever it was. I'd sort of watched them while my mum was puffing on a Super King till 1 in the morning. So yeah, I ended up clocking up a lot more movies than I actually appreciated. And until I started hanging around with academics and realised, oh, I've seen that, you know.
And you were born in the East End, right? But you grew up in Watford.
Yeah, well, yeah. I was born at UCH. My dad's family are all from Dalston, and so we spent a lot of time there. And he worked for the AA. We lived in the centre of town and blah, blah, blah. Then they moved to Stanmore, which is an incredibly posh, expensive part of part of London. And we ended up on a council estate called South Oxley, which was between Watford and Wembley, and within sort of, you know, a 10-minute drive of Stanmore, I ended up sort of dumped in this council estate, tin house council estate, which was where I, you know, and then got off of that estate as quickly as I possibly could. So I lied about my age, and back in the old days when you could get a cotton bud and a bit of bleach and actually change your date of birth on a few documents, I made myself a year or two older and then got into drama school and got off the estate as quickly as I could. But, you know, I got a grant. They paid my tuition and a tiny bit of subsistence, and I did all sorts of crappy jobs to sort of keep myself going through the 3 years there. But it was a really interesting time. And as you know, I think that politically, it was quite interesting. That sort of late 80s, mid to late 80s, when the revolution was going the wrong way. It's like we'd all been hoping for it to go that way. And then all Thatcher and yuppies and all the rest of it. But it was still a very interesting, creative time, you know.
There was still
Red Wedge and people sort of rebelling against where the world was going. And not having to pay for your education meant that you could be part of all of that. You
know? Yeah. Now, the first film I see on your list, absolutely superb British film called Billy Liar from 1963. And it's brilliant.
When I was 16, 17, I sort of discovered British kitchen sink dramas and those black and white movies, and they were this wave of films that were just mind-blowing and brilliant. And I was sort of in awe of all of them. So whether it was Saturday Night, Sunday Morning, or Kind of Loving, or even the slightly more commercial ones like Whistle Down the Wind, you know, they're all just brilliant. And there were these wave of incredible directors, Tony Richardson, John Schlesinger, Carol Reese, all these guys that were doing these amazing things with this wave of, you know, angry young men actors that were really just incredibly charismatic characters. And out of all of those, I picked Billy Liar because it makes a great social comment and it's a satire as well. And I watch it and think it's hilarious. But there's also something about the fact that it's making all these comments about the class comments and about sort of, you know, the differentiation between the working classes and the arty classes. The thing with the kitchen sink dramas is there was they represented the angry young man. So the smart, artistic, cool young man, you know, the guy that should be writing comedy sketches, that should be doing, you know, even though he gets a letter from a comedy, you know, a British comedian, London comedian, said, come down to London. Danny Boone says, come down to London, I love your material. Danny Boone likes me jokes, he wants me to go and see him in London, and he still can't go because there's just too much sort of, you know, grim up north sort of nonsense that tethers you to where you're from, you know. And I think that's that message, everything about that film works and resonates. Mm. It's beautifully shot, brilliantly acted. I was very lucky to work with Tom Courtney many years later, and I was just in awe of how brilliant he was as an actor. But there's one scene in Billy Liar which is just a 2-minute take of him wandering around the office speaking to himself, and it's this seamless, just endless stream of comic genius and imagination, and you look at him doing that, there's like a brilliant actor at his peak playing a role that he's starred in on stage that he's totally in control of, just tearing things up, and it's brilliantly funny. And I sort of think he's a genius, probably one of the best British actors that we've ever had.
Yeah.
And I really wanted to mention him when we were talking about that whole black and white 50s kitchen sink film thing. And that's why Billy Liar's up there.
Well, this is a perfect time to go to your second film, The Spy Who Came In From the Cold.
Shot
in Berlin.
Spectacular.
So, you know, to tell me something about this that you like.
Well, I think that's the other end of that fantastic black and white British kitchen sink explosion. That technically isn't kitchen sink, it's a spy drama, but it sort of lifted all the best elements from kitchen sink. You know, people are grubby and they're in... It's rainy and miserable and everyone's wearing a Mac that needs to go to the dry cleaners, you know, and it's got all of the all of the tropes of Kitchen Sink, but then all of the, you know, the brilliance of that superb plot and the and the brilliance of the of the book and the characters that, that that have been created, and so I think it's a sort of hybrid, really, and as a pretty much a high point for British films, I think. So Richard Burton's, you know, superb, and then so you've got all of that character study, you have all of this political backdrop, which was so relevant at the time, you know, there is a wall and if you go across it you'd get shot and people being sneaked in and out, and then this fantastic plot which I won't go into because it's got such a zing, there's a double zinger of the storyline, you don't see that coming. And I also think there's this fantastic sort of dueling actors with those two, where you think it's going to be the Richard Burton show, and then the German actor that rocks up to that everybody knows from Fahrenheit 451, and
Oscar Werner,
and from the Tin Drum. You know, I don't think Burton was expecting to be sort of knocked off his horse as like that. Because when they do those scenes together, that's like, wow. That's two genius actors. It's not a one horse race. You know, and there's some brilliant stuff in that. And of course, you know, it's one of the best spy stories ever. And without going into it, it's got that going on. But that's a great film. If you take Billy Liar and The Spy Who Came In from the
bookends
cult, as bookends to that epoch of sort of British filmmaking, then you've got everything covered.
Nice. And apparently up until this point, Burton, he was considered a bit of a wooden movie actor, but this changed all that.
Well, that's... You can't say that after you've seen that film.
No, exactly.
You know? And you're right, actually, because after that, that's when he did Beckett.
Yeah.
And that's when he started getting his... He got his 7 Oscar nominations without winning, you know. But this is where it all starts.
This is where it all started,
That's where you start taking him seriously as a proper actor. You're right.
And Le Carré was actually working in Berlin. He just started with MI5 or 6, and that's where he wrote it.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was and it was his first filmed novel, you know. Which
And interesting, because what John le Carré does is that he can pick any one of his characters and write a book about them.
Yeah.
So anybody that's in that, in the circus, anybody that's a peripheral, anyone, they can go off and have a whole chapter about them. That's why Tinker Tailor Soldier is so great, is that you really don't know who the lead is or where the story's going to go, because each one of the characters is so interesting and it's got such an interesting sort of backstory and contribution to the plot. So if The Spy Gone In From the Cold ends differently, if George Smiley had taken a bullet in that, then there would be a totally different future.
Yes.
You know? They wouldn't be able to do any of those other things that came off from that first novel or that first film.
Thank you.
And so moving on to the next film here, which is RoboCop. What a great, completely different subject.
Well, but, this is the great thing, you know.
It's a great movie.
Exactly. So I remember seeing it at Turnpike Lane Coronet when I was at drama school. So I think it was 88 or so, I think, around about then. And you know, people were... It was being sort of reviewed and considered as some sort of action-packed blood and guts schlock.
Mm.
And I'd seen Verhoeven's other stuff, you know, those sort of Danish biker movies and that he'd done with Rutger Hauer. I thought, there must be something more to it than this.
Yeah.
And then I went to see this thing that was, for the first time, I mean, it was American satire.
Mm.
And they... You know, it was such a clever piss take that it was taking the piss out of its own producers and its own production and its own studio, and they were so they had no idea.
No, it went over their heads.
Exactly, it was like someone pulling a face behind their hand at you, letting you know that listen, we know these guys are all tossers. Watch this, and the satire in it was brilliant.
Yeah.
And then there's all this religious iconography in it. You know, RoboCop walks on water when he takes his helmet off. He's got a halo because of Paul Verhoeven. Very nearly became a priest. He trained as a priest for years and years, and how he managed to sneak all that in a film about a giant
remarkable
cyborg shooting people up, and the irony of it, you know, that when the Ed 209 shoots the executive into ribbons, and then the CEO of the company says, "I'm very disappointed, Dick." You know, that's just, this stuff was years ahead of its time. Nobody had done that sort of satire and played it straight-laced and straight-faced. It was fantastic. And it also, it's a Western, really. You know, it's Shane or any of those things. You know, I ain't like that no more. You know, the cop comes back and kills the bad guys. Even some of the way the shootouts are done with these classic sort of gunslinging poses, you know, just give you that Western thing. And it also... It's a precursor to all of those superhero stuff that we're all, you know, we're sick to death of now. But that idea that you can put on a suit and be indestructible and right some wrongs, it really touches people on a level that makes, you know, if only I could be that guy, if only I had that suit, I'd go and sort those fellas out, you know. And there's something that's why superhero films work. And they're all based on Greek gods, really. And I loved all of that's in RoboCop, you know. The adverts that takes the piss out of the concept of how OCP, you know, the government's more, the company's more important than the government. The company's more important than the police.
Well, and we're almost getting to
and
that.
And it's exactly where
now.
We're going now, isn't it? You know, exactly. It's like it was such a precursor.
Talking of the suit, apparently Paul Weller was losing 3 pounds of weight per day sweating because the suit was so hot, and they had to fit an air conditioner to it. and then when he was in the suit, he couldn't fit in the car.
Oh yeah,
he had to do the rest in underwear.
That's right, sitting his pants in the car. But that,
very
I mean,
funny.
But that's the joy of that film, is that the cutaways, the way it's edited together, you know, it's made by a really intelligent director. The only thing that ruins the film, it doesn't ruin it, but if RoboCop, the actual, you know, cyborg, wasn't on the poster, you know, you'd have this brilliant reveal about what he looks like.
Yeah,
you know,
point.
And I wish they'd done good that point. Instead of using that as a selling point, you know, you because there's this reveal about what is this thing, what is, and then you see it in its in its full glory. And it was a bit sort of ruined by its own marketing. But that's my only gripe about it. How he sneaked that past the censors, the Orion, the executives, or how he did that is miraculous, really, because you know, he made that one slip through the net.
We'll be right back.
Next, we're going to go to, we've got two great comedies on this list, The Producers.
Ah.
Mel Brooks' writing Oscar.
Yeah.
And a first film he made.
Yeah.
What do you like about this?
Mel Brooks' acceptance speech just sums it up. Mel Brooks, when he won the Oscar, he said, "I'd like to thank the Academy from the bottom of my heart. Ba-boom, ba-boom, ba-boom."
Walked off. Yeah, like, wasn't expecting it.
And that was, but that, you know, that's, that. I mean, The Producers is, it's so funny that I can't even look at stills of it without laughing. I can't even see a picture. But, yeah. You know, every line is that, "That's my Hitler." You know, everything that anybody says in that film is a joke. And it's so fast, it's like you missed that one, we're on to the next.
Yeah.
And the fact that it is, you couldn't do it now. The fact it's about a man making a musical about Hitler, you having those goose-stepping showgirls singing "Springtime for Hitler," or, you know, all of those things are just, they're beyond modern day satire now. You might upset somebody. It's Mel Brooks.
PC.
Everything he says is upsetting to somebody.
Well, it almost didn't get released. Joseph Levine wouldn't release it afterwards. Yeah. And then Peter Sellers
saved
it. Someone screened it for him while he was making a movie. And he rang Levine and persuaded him to...
No,
to
I think he underwrote it. I think he said, "Look, if it loses any money, I'll pay you."
And there you go.
And he did. He had to cough up. He was like, "Well, he hasn't made this. Oh, all right, Peter Sellers, you know, this should be seen." I mean, there isn't anything that's... And taking that, like, blacklisted actors as well and giving them the lead role, you know, taking blacklisted writers and getting them involved. Everything about the film, and it's a satire on Broadway shows and on the concept of musicals, you know, and you can only take the mickey out of high-end, finessed, polished stuff like Broadway musicals if you're as good at doing it, you know.
That's right.
If he wanted to write a serious musical, if he wanted to be Sondheim, Mel Brooks would have written a serious musical and it would have been Sondheim. They're of the same caliber as anything that was going on Broadway at the time.
Trouble, what a sad story. Needed a new leader to restore its former glory. Where, oh, where was he?
Where could that man be?
We looked around, and then we found the man for you and me. And now it's
springtime for Hitler and Germany. Deutschland is happy and gay.
We're marching to a faster pace. Look out, here comes the master race.
Springtime for Hitler and Germany.
Winter for Poland and France.
Born in Dusseldorf, and that is why they call me Rolf.
Don't be stupid, be a smarty. Come and join the Nazi party.
We'll be right back.
But you must be a big fan of Sellers, right? Because Pink Panther Strikes Again is the next one on your list.
Any Pink Panther film. What I love about, they're very soft spot because it's a sort of thing that me and my wife sort of share. But it's this again. You look at that and you think, there's no jokes in this. Why is it so funny? Mm. And it's like they've taken a completely serious script about someone robbing a diamond or a servant's been killed in a stately home. And then it somehow magically gets turned into the funniest thing you've ever seen without there being any jokes. Every now and then there's one or two jokes, like, does your dog bite? You know, that, you know.
Yeah.
No. You said your dog doesn't bite. That is not my dog. You know, those simple jokes are in there every now and then just to make it a comedy. But everything else is just not on the page. It's just, you know. And I saw this brilliant interview with Peter Sellers where he said, and it was sort of the secret of comedy for me. And it's like, the thing about Clouseau is he's an idiot. And he knows he's an idiot. But he doesn't want anyone else to know he's an idiot. And he thinks he's got away with it because he's an idiot. So he thinks he's got away with that, you know. So nobody's noticed that I'm actually... you see that, then... And this is a sign of real genius. So he explains this, like, this is what's funny about it. You know, oh, right, okay. And then you'd think, watching Peter Sellers do that thought process and now understanding what he's saying would make it less funny. Right? Mm. But it's even funnier.
So then in 2008, Telstar, you directed Telstar for the first directing job.
Yeah, I did. I'd written the play before Lockstock. So I'd written the play in 96, 97 as this drinker with an acting problem. And I'd done the read-through. I'd organised a read-through in this disused pub in Stockwell, which was where I was sort of my abode. And then I did another reading, which was great. It was at Payne's Plough, a theatre company, and so as far as I was concerned, I was going to make this play into, you know, into an event, and all I needed to do was do like a terrible Chicken Tonight advert or something, and then I'd have a few grand and I'd put this play on over a pub somewhere. As it happened, Lockstock happened. I ended up running around the world, being a film star for a year, and I came back to the play. I stopped everything all of that silly stuff and really focused on it. We got the Arts Council involved. We put the play on a tour. You know, the reviews were spectacular because people turned up wanting to take the piss. Like, that idiot from Lockstock's written a play. This would be great. Let's go and stick the boot in on this. And then they'd come out saying, no, this is really classy. Mm. Took it into the West End. Simon Jordan helped me bankroll putting the show on in town. And we got an Olivier nominate. Con got nominated for an Olivier. We got a load of other nominations. It was a serious thing. And so I thought, right, I've done that now. Now I'll go back to America with my tail between my legs and do some terrible films and try and earn some money. You know, I've taken like a year out to put this play on. Mm. I got it to the Olivier's. I couldn't go any further with this silly idea of a play that I'd written with James Hicks, my best mate. Sort of, you know, he helped out on the play. He was a great co-writer. And then I was in America auditioning for some terrible stuff. You know, and I was about to cover my face in latex and be a baddie in some awful sci-fi thing, sci-fi TV movie. Simon Jordan, he called me up out of the blue and said, "You write a film script for this play?" Because he, you know, as I said, he not only bankrolled Telstar as a play, he's part of. There was a group of investors, but he phoned me up when I was about to, you know, go into some terrible sci-fi show for a bit, and said. Fuck that, come home, we'll make the film. And literally, come home, we'll make the film. And he basically, you know, put the money in the bank, let me put the production together. And we did a brilliant set builder at Twickenham Studios and made the movie. But it was simply, it was just on the whim of Simon, who's, you know, just said, well, let's come home and make the film. The co-producers were Dave Reed and Adam Bolin, and the cast, the brilliant cast I had, you know, James Corden and obviously Kevin Spacey, but James Corden and Tom Burke and you know, all these actors that are now absolutely sort of household names. They did it because they saw the play, you know. Their agents were saying, why are you doing this? It's going to be terrible. Mm. And because they'd seen the play, I got everybody to sort of volunteer and put their hand up. So Sean Evans, you know, all of these guys did fantastic turns in it. And it, I'm really, really proud of it as a movie. It came out brilliantly.
Can we go now to another film on your list, The Ipcress File? What an amazing film. It probably wouldn't have been made if James Bond hadn't have happened.
Well, yeah, as Harry Saltzman doing his sort of antidote, isn't he?
Yeah.
So Saltzman and Broccoli were the producers of James Bond, and then Saltzman wanted to do his own. You know, like, I'll do my own one. The book had been a big success, but it was the thing about The Ipcress File is that it's the first film that you really notice it's brilliantly directed.
Mm.
It's Sidney Furie directed it, who'd done some fantastic black and white films. He started off, you know, doing Cliff Richard stuff and what have you, but he sort of graduated, and that it won the best BAFTA for best director as well as, you know, best film. But there's so many clever things in that movie that you don't notice until they're either pointed out or somebody explains them to you. Like, everything is shot through an open door.
Mm.
So you always feel that you're eavesdropping.
Mm.
Everything's shot through glass. If there's a piece of glass, if you can shoot it through a windscreen or you can shoot it through a window, then he did. There's a brilliant section where Michael Caine's has his huge fight with his great big bald henchman on the steps of the Albert Hall, but it's shot from inside a phone box and it never leaves the phone box. So you're watching this. Anyone else would have gone, well, we'll have a, you know, we need to stunt coordinator in, and we need this, that, and the other, and we'll have all this sort of, you know. But no, let's just stay in the phone box and watch this.
Mm.
So you're drawn into this espionage, you know, and the idea that it's the antithesis of Bond. There's this bloke who's, you know, living in a basement flat and doing a cookery course, and he's on, you know, whatever it is, you know, £10, 12 shillings a week, and plus it's faster filling his expensive chip.
Yeah,
you know, there's more about the paperwork, and even if you want a gun, there's a load of paperwork. If you want to order a raid, there's a load of paperwork to be filled in.
Yeah,
and that the whole thing, the actual brain drain thing is that's a little bit. That's a little bit fantastic, you know. That's a little bit Austin Powers, but it's dressed up in something so believable and real,
makes it credible.
And of course, you know, the John Barry soundtrack is amazing.
Yeah,
you know, and the idea that it's character driven, but also that it is about a mole. You know, it's about finding a mole. Ultimately, that's all it's about. It's about serving up Harry Palmer, who's further enough down the food chain to be mole bait. You know, that's all he is, really. Mm. You know, and then nobody gives a toss about him. I mean, they're quite blatant about that, you know.
You know that Harry Saltzman had suggested Harry H. Corbett in the main role.
Ooh. Well, he was a very serious actor.
Yes.
He hated the fact that he was stuck with
Steptoe.
Because he'd done Richard II on stage.
Interesting idea, isn't it?
Yeah, it would have been quite good. You know, but there's an element of that. Someone must have told Michael Caine that, because there's an element of that about the way he
does it.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I mean, what I love about the Caine performance in it, it's before he quite adopts that persona, that Michael Caine, you know, that everyone does an impersonation of. He's quite subtle.
He's still experimenting.
Yeah, and he's quite well-spoken, and he's attempting to get along with these middle-class people. There's one little bit where he's, which must have been improvised, where he's trying to walk past a girl and she goes left and he goes right, and they go like that, and they do this little side-by-side, and he just under his breath, he says, "Thank you for a wonderful evening," and then carries
That's
on going,
right.
Which is like, you see little flashes of the sort of the little wide boy bits, and you just know that wasn't in the script, you know. That's him just throwing something around there. But in particular, that is a very good example of a major leading man, you know, an international star. That's him arriving in that film, and you go, right, okay,
that's right,
right, yeah, you are net, yeah, you're allowed. Yeah, you're up there. You're in the same room as Burton and O'Toole and Harris and all the rest of them. Off you go. But mostly, it's a brilliantly directed movie. It's not big, it's not flashy, it's just directed with real class.
So another film on this, which I love on your list, is Harold and Maud.
Yeah, I love Harold and Maud. It's so wrong, it's right, you know.
Yeah.
Everything about it is there isn't a second of it that you aren't intrigued, like entertained and a little bit shocked by, you know.
Yes.
And for anyone that doesn't know, it's about a sort of rich New England 18-year-old who ends up having an affair with a near 80-year-old Holocaust survivor, and it's in every but she's
and they meet at a funeral.
Yeah, of course, because he's got this macabre death obsession.
Yes.
And she's has as well, but in a different way. You know, you slowly find out she's a Holocaust survivor, and she's embracing life in a way that you know every moment is a blessing, and it's about finding the joy in death to a certain extent. It's like, because death is part of life, and that's just as much of a celebration. It's a relentlessly brilliant comedy satire that even when it's taking itself seriously, you know what it is? It's not that it doesn't take itself seriously. It's just it never treats itself like a comedy.
Mm.
It just happens to be brilliantly funny and disturbing. But it's always played from the sympathetic, empathetic point of view of a young kid who knows nothing about the world.
Yeah.
And you see, you just, you know, and obviously, Bud Core, you know, that's his greatest moment, you know, it's just everything about it is a lot of people's favourite film. And also what I loved about it, and some people don't, is the way that Hal Ashby just said to Cat Stevens, who was a massive star at the time,
that's right, yeah,
just do a soundtrack for me.
Yeah.
And he literally, you know, got his guitar out of the box and does a soundtrack. Yeah. It's not, he doesn't do a score. He just does this brilliant little folky arranged, you know, bunch of songs and intros and bits and pieces throughout it. And it's just as good as Simon and Garfunkel doing The Graduate, you know, but even a bit more low key and a bit more scratchy, a bit more Woody Guthrie sounding. And it's brilliant, you know, that soundtrack. And that's one of those great films where the soundtrack and the, you know, like There Will Be Blood or any of those where the soundtrack and the film are sort of inseparable. I love that about Harold and Maud. It's that, you know, and it just ends with that beautiful little tune that you can't get out of your head and he's skipping down the road. It's a fantastic film.
Well, if you want to sing out, sing out. And if you want to be free, be free. 'Cause there's a million things to be, you know that there are. And if you want to live high, live high. And if you want to live low, live low. 'Cause there's a million ways to go, you know that there are. You can do what you want, the opportunity's on. And if you find a new way, you can do it today. You can make it all true, and you can make it undo. You see, ah, it's easy. Ah, you only need to know. Well, if you want to sing out, sing out. And if you want to be free, be free. 'Cause there's a million things to be. You know that there are, 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 you know that there are.
So how did you get involved with Creation Stories?
Well, that was really simple, you know. That was such a simple thing, because it was just a case of Irving Welsh saying, have you seen Telstar? This is the guy that's got to make this script. And Dean Kavanagh is his writing partner. Have you seen Telstar? He's the guy that's got to make the script. And then eventually, you know what Alan McGee's like. Alan hadn't seen Telstar. And he wanted to meet me first. And meeting Alan is like, you sit there while he talks across you. And then he sort of slowly casts in an eye and see what you like. And then eventually, over the course of that meeting, you know, a couple of things got, he asked me a couple of questions, and obviously I really do know my music. I really do know his history and his label and everything. And we started having a really interesting conversation about obscure bands, blah, blah, blah. And then he went off and saw Telstar on the phone and said, yeah, they, oh, brilliant, that's it. So it was just a case of Telstar was this little time bomb. You know, it's like, if you're going to make a film about Creation Records, then what better audition could you have than making a film about Joe Meek? You know, it's the same craziness, same everything, same authenticity that he wanted. So as simple as that. And then, again, you know, you're working with a creative team that let you get on with it, especially Danny Boyle. It was, you know, he just thought, right, genius, off you go. And that was it. You know, he didn't, there was never nothing from him other than he saw some rushes and just kept saying nice things. And so I was allowed to... I was allowed to flex my muscles again and do all the stuff. I mean, I think of Telstar as a companion piece to Creation to a certain extent, because there's a lot of the same sort of tropes in there. But the thing with Creation is that people remember it. People were there. People know what the 90s were like. People know what was going on. People can celebrate the fact there was 5 minutes when the big studios got, you know, the big labels got told to, you know, they just weren't up to speed with the curve. They didn't know what was going on. And there were all these amazing, you know, a bit like, you know, the punk days.
That period,
And it's great in Creation to touch on the punk stuff. And that's the touchstone. You know, you go, right, that's... It, we did that again, you know. Alan made punk too, you know.
Your I have to say your portrayal of Malcolm McLaren was perfect. It was great.
Oh, thank you. Yeah,
and because I used to hang out with Malcolm a lot back in the day, and it was like seeing him being brought back to life. Oh, it was very, very good.
I got taken out, and I remember having a big chat with Malcolm, and he just went over everything, and, you know, and he described everything in that wonderful sort of detail. That
he had a great take on everything. Oh.
And he everything he had was a slightly different... But he went right back to the shop, you know, and I said, pistol. Pistol is active, that's the word. You know, and the shop was called Sex, so of course it would be the active part of the shop, you know. Yeah. And so he did, and the way that he's delivering the genius going on behind him is just so engaging. It was wonderful. Yeah. And the only reason I played it in the film was because I had so many people lined up that were going to play the part.
Oh, really?
Because it's like, we'd be done in 2 hours. You just come in, do the thing, it's going to be shoot.
Really, yeah.
So it's going to be Benny Cumberbatch, who was going to do it, you know. But oh, yeah, he'll do it. Oh, no, he's not. Paul Bettany was going to do it. Mm. Oh, Paul would have been great. No, he's in New York. You'll have to fly him out and put him up. And it was like, in the end, the producer said, well, why don't you do it? And Danny was the same. Well, you do it, because you do an impersonation of him every time you're talking about him. So why don't you just, you do it.
Just pull a hunchback.
So let me ask you about after Harold and Maude, we got Robin and Marion.
Now, I know
you're a big Richard Lester
fan. Richard Lester's, you know, all the Beatles films and then all the other genius that he did, you know, How I Won the War and all those other fantastic films that he did. But there's something about this overlooked movie that I can't watch it without bursting into tears.
I haven't seen it. It's...
I cannot watch that film without literally, I'm inconsolable. It's like at the end of the movie. There's something it was a terrible flop. But it basically, the gist of it is, it starts off with Sean Connery's Robin of Loxley, and Nicole Williamson's is Little Johnny's sidekick, and they're doing this sort of the tail end of the crusade with Richard Harris, who is this megalomaniac Richard the Lionheart, who's insane, and the only person that he sort of will take any jip from is Connery, and it's quite brutal and unpleasant and spiteful, that opening sequence, and Richard Harris that dies. So, you know, Loxley and Little John say, well, nothing for us to do now. Let's, you know, go home. So they go back to Nottingham and, and they're sort of, it's about being old and trying to rekindle what went on before. They go back to Nottingham, wander around. There's the same old, the sheriff's net is Robert Shaw, right? So he's tired. He's bored. He's had enough. There's a new load of sort of legislation and there's all these other sort of various knights and what have you that are still doing the same old robbing from the poor, and basically they sort of get the gang back together and have a go, but in a way that's really believable and it's just got there's a little bit of arthritis about it, you know, and that's you know, and it's and he finds Maid Marian who's Audrey Hepburn and has joined a nunnery and a hospital, and she doesn't want anything to do with him. You pissed off to the wars, you went off to the king. You know, why would I want to talk to you? I'm looking after people depend on me. And he tries to break her, they try to rekindle this thing, and it sort of doesn't work, and then it does, because Robert Shaw decides that's it. Like, Robert Shaw is the same, he's just this bored old men that want to relive that thing. So they end up, the crescendo of the film is Sean Connery and Robert Shaw having a battle of champions, because obviously Connery's, a couple of people recognise him, and they all get this gang of peasants together, but they're rubbish, you know, and they're going to get slaughtered by the king's men, so they decide to have champions on combat, just because there's these two old guys that are so, you know, they want to relive it, and Robert Shaw and Sean Connery, one of the greatest fights in history, and Russia with love, you know, they do the same thing in chainmail, but it's Richard Lester, so it's all a bit cranky and clunky, and they're old men and they can't quite hold the sword yet. And then,
interesting.
And then the end, the crescendo at the end of it is this tremendous. I can't tell you. I can't talk about the end without welling up. But what happens at the end is a spectacular. It's a gesture. It's the ultimate gesture of romance.
Great.
With Catherine, and you realise Catherine Hepburn's the greatest actress that ever lived, and there's her and Connery in that last moment, and I can't see why everybody felt that they were robbed by the ending of this film, and it isn't. That is the end. The end of the film. This is that people don't.
It's right.
They say it, you know, and there's no winners in it, and it is. It's a film about realising that you'll always be in love with somebody. It doesn't matter what you do, what happens, how it is, and you. Even if you wish you could, you weren't. You will, and those, you know. So I just a spectacular film and massively overlooked. Nobody watched it, and so I thought, I went through this list of movies. And
it's interesting you put it on the list.
I thought, well, what's the film that always makes me cry? Well, it's that, you know. I mean, I'll get a bit, I'll bubble up a bit at the end of Dr. Zhivago. I'll be absolutely honest, you know. I sometimes have a little tear in my eye at the end of every Scissorhand. But this is the actual, there's something.
This is the one. So, Nick, what's in the future for you? Anything?
Well, yeah, it's been great, actually. I've directed a film in Poland, in Polish, with a completely, you know, Polish cast and Polish crew, which was an absolute joy. And it's a sort of Blake Edwards-inspired comedy, you know. So basically there was a British comedy called Perfect Wedding. It's a stage play. It was a big hit over here, ran for years and years, like a sort of Brian Rix bedroom farce sort of thing, you know, but one of those. It's still being performed in Warsaw. It's been running forever. And so technically it's a film version of that. But what we did, and working with a brilliant producer who's a really dear friend of mine, but we updated it, made a movie script out of it, gave lots of other peripheral characters, moved it around, and then made it into this fantastic, elaborate Mel Brooks / Blake Edwards sort of caper comedy, but keeping the structure of the play and some of the dialogue. The Polish movies are always tremendously good. They're what nobody understands. It's always the DOPs will always be, you know, Oscar nominated DOPs. There's loads of Polish renowned Oscar nominated directors of photography. They have their own film industry, which is not just sort of bespoke because it's Polish language, but it's really, really high end. Mm. Some of the best film schools in the world are in Warsaw. Mm. So when you go there, I've got Polanski's crew and technically the best people that I could possibly have. And the actors, if you've seen any of their other stuff, they're extraordinary, brilliant actors. But they don't really get a chance to, you know, have a bum fight. I have a bum fight in the middle of the film. You know, I had the two lead actors, the very revered actors, having a cake fight and attacking each other with French batons, you know, with French sticks.
They did
the whole Blake Edwards, Not Now, Kato through this whole hotel. And it was just a joy. And every day, people were so supportive. It was such fun. It was such a laugh.
Excellent. It's been great talking to you and finding out all about, how you started out and about how the directing came about. And I'd like to thank you on the behalf of Mr. DeMille FM for taking part in this. And we'll go out with some music from another of your favourite films.
Trouble, oh, trouble set me free. I have seen your face and it's too much for me. Trouble, oh trouble, can't you see? You're eating my heart away and there's nothing much left of me. I drank your wine and you have made your with mine, so won't you be fair? So won't you be fair? I don't want no more of you, so won't you be kind to me? Just let me go where I have to go there. Trouble. Trouble, move away. I have seen your face and it's too much for me today. Trouble, trouble, can't you see? You have made me a wreck. Now won't you leave me in my misery? I can see death's disguise hanging on me, hanging on me. I'm beat, I'm torn, shattered and tossed and worn. Too shocking to see, too shocking to see. Trouble, move from me.
death. Now won't you leave me in my misery? Trouble.